Okay, today is Thursday, August 29th, 2013. We're here in the office of Mary Dell Chilton at Syngenta in Durham, North Carolina. So just to start off here, if you could maybe tell us when you were born, where you were born. I know, 1939, and also some of your family background, your parents, any siblings, things like that.
Okay, well, as you said, I was born in 1939 in Indianapolis, Indiana. My dad was an insurance salesman, so we did a lot of moving around. The family did a lot of moving around. I can't remember a whole lot of that. The first thing I remember, I was given to my grandparents. We lived in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And the exact reason I was given to my grandparents is lost in the mists of history. But I think my mother was having some problems. I had a brother just a year and a half older than I am. He was, let's face it, he was a hellion, and he was very aggressive toward me, so it may have been, to some extent, for my own safety and comfort. It may be that my mother wanted me to have the experience growing up that she had. She grew up in Southern Pines, North Carolina. I don't know. I really don't know what the reasons are, and maybe there were many, and maybe they were complex. But anyway, so I was given to my grandparents, and that's the first home that I can remember. A big stucco house with an upstairs with three bedrooms and an attic that I like to explore, and a big garage. I like to jump off the roof with my playmates. Made my grandmother very angry.
About how old were you when you moved to your grandparents?
I must have been three or four. It was certainly a year before I started going to kindergarten. And at my grandfather, I should tell more about my grandparents since they were the ones who raised me. My grandfather owned the bookstore in Southern Pines, and he owned a building, a big double building. And my grandmother had the store next to his storefront. She sold dresses. She had Mrs. Hayes' shop. And she sold the first ready-made hats that were sold in that time. She went to New York on buying trips. One time she brought me back a beautiful little blue velveteen dress with a lace collar. They had a photograph made of me in that dress. I remember it. I even remember the itchy dress, but I loved it. It was so beautiful. Anyway, so my grandmother was a businesswoman, and my grandfather was supposedly a businessman, although the family history has it that she was the real brains of both of those businesses, which made money. There's a photograph of the 50th year anniversary of his bookstore, and it has my I'm in the middle of the picture with my legs all wrapped around each other because it was so cold. I was trying to stay warm, and my grandmother and grandfather were in that picture. My mother is in it, and a few other more distant relatives. He gave away, this was just after the war years, and he gave away nylon stockings, one package to each lady who came into the store. I think you didn't even have to buy anything, you just got one for coming in. That was a big deal. Stockings were very expensive.
And then that was a way to sort of bring in customers and...
Yeah, it was just thank you for your 50 years of business is what it was, I guess. So it was a very festive occasion.
And did you he had a bookstore. So you know, I think that you're kind of have this opportunity to be surrounded by books. Were you sort of in there going through the books, reading?
Well, there are two answers. One is I was in heaven because I could borrow any comic book that came into the store, just so I kept it clean and put it back within a day or two. So, excuse me, I certainly exercised that privilege. But the other thing is my grandfather knew a fair amount about children's books, and so all the classics he brought home and read to me. I was read to a lot as a little child. And I became an avid reader myself. I read every horse story that the library had, Albert Payson Terhune's dog stories, yeah. And I got into the Nancy Drew mysteries and the Hardy Boy mysteries and all that. So I'm a good reader to this day. I enjoy reading. Okay, so I went to Catholic school. We weren't Catholics. My grandfather was a pillar of the Episcopal Church, in fact. But the Catholic school was supposedly a better school academically. So I went to this kindergarten starting at age four. They let me in kind of early. Hmm. It was my birthday in mid-year. I was kind of, between ages for the grade, between grades for the age or something. So I was entering first grade at age five, which would be pretty early now. I guess I did okay in school. I went to that Catholic school for grades 1 through 4. My grandfather died long about there, and my mother, I was still left with my to live with my grandmother to keep her company, I guess. And my mother insisted that I need to go to public school, so they switched me over, and they gave me a bunch of standardized tests, and they wrote the results on my report card, and it would show what the subject was, mathematics or whatever, and then it would show, you know, this grade, this month in that grade is my level where I had tested. And it was kind of astonishing as a rising fifth grader. I was testing, you know, at 9th, 10th, 11th grade in some of the subjects, and that was the first inkling we had that I was bright. I had the feeling in Catholic school that I was struggling and could, you know, wasn't really very good at things. Mm-hmm. But maybe part of what I wasn't very good at was the litany and some of the praying, things like that. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's you know, was religion influential at all at this time? You know, were you attending church, things like that, or was it kind of just something in an environment that you were just around?
They drummed a lot of Catholicism into us as Catholic school kids. I guess I believed it. I don't know. I was a little kid, being very critical. My grandfather took me to Sunday school at the Episcopal Church. I was a choir girl, the rest of that. And I don't know, as I thought a great deal about it one way or the other. I just, that's what you did. So I did it.
So you're testing really well at these various subjects. What are the subjects that you're, you know, really enjoying that you're, you know, doing well at, or, you know, are you enjoying the subjects this time?
I loved school. I loved my teacher. We had one teacher for all subjects in that era. I guess they still do with youngsters that age, don't they? No, I don't remember anything outstanding that I liked particularly. I liked it all. I liked the teacher and I worked hard for it. And I liked to draw horses. And I loved horses. I was crazy about horses. And so we struck a deal. My grandfather wanted me to take piano lessons. I wanted riding lessons. So the deal was that if I would take the piano lessons and practice, then I could have a riding lesson every week. so that was fine. And I kept on with the writing lessons, but my piano teacher gave up on me after about a year and a half, I think. I wouldn't really practice to suit her. So let's see, things went along like that. Now I was living with my grandmother, going to public school.
How has that changed, you know, kind of moving from a Catholic school to a public school?
I didn't have to wear dresses anymore. That's an important change. Catholic school, you had to wear a dress. Not a uniform, but a dress. So I could wear pants. I liked that. I was a tomboy. No two ways about it. I played with the boy next door who was a year or two older than I was. And I'm trying to remember, somewhere, I guess at about the time I became a teenager, my mother decided that I should go back and live with the family. I think my brother by that time had become a little more civil, although he still would snarl at me and say, "I'm going to beat you to a bloody pulp," and I believed him. But anyway, seventh grade, I was back living with my family. My grandmother kept my dog, because my mother already had a dog. I couldn't bring my dog home.
And this is back in Indianapolis?
They were living in Elgin, Illinois by then. As I said, my father moved around a bit. And by this time, he is becoming an executive in the Chicago office of his insurance company. It is the Continental Casualty Company, Continental Insurance Company Group. They were the, you might remember, you might not, that there were machines in airports with a picture of a Continental soldier on them that sold flight insurance. That was his company.
Hmm.
Anyway, eventually, to jump ahead in the story, my father became the president of the company in New York, and then chairman of the board, I think. I think he was chairman of the board after that. So he rose very high. But all that was yet to come. So we were not well off. My father bought his first house in Elgin, and it had four finished rooms and an unfinished attic. It had two bedrooms and a living room and a kitchen. That was the house, and a basement, an unfinished basement. So my bedroom was, I slept with my mother. My mother and dad had twin beds, so I slept with my mother. And I had one drawer of her dresser for my underwears and two or three hangers in her closet. So that was my space, not much. And I remember when we got our first black and white television set sometime around that period. Let's see, going back to school, I went to a junior high school nearby. And again, I loved it. I loved school. I loved all my teachers and did rather well. I think I got good grades. I got grades. And I don't have a clear memory of what those grades were. I didn't keep so much track of them until I got into high school. And at that point, I can remember that I was a straight A student. So probably I was before that. I don't remember exactly.
Were you still doing writing lessons? Or were there other...
No horses, no.
No.
As I said, my father was not prosperous. He became a wealthy man, I guess. Middling wealthy. But no, at that time, my mother actually took a job as an agent for hearing aids. My grandmother was deaf. I didn't tell you that. My grandmother was deaf, so she was very familiar with the problems of deaf people. My grandmother had a hearing aid. It was more or less the size of your tape recorder, a little bigger than that. And she had a battery pack that was as big as my whole hand. She wore it in a little satin pouch made for it on her leg, strapped around her waist, I guess. And it really didn't work terribly well. It worked. I mean, she could hear, but she had to look at you to figure out what you were saying. Anyway, so my mother was interested in that, and she went to work for Sonatone, actually, the company that made my grandmother's hearing aid. And she had the agency there and fitted people with hearing aids and sold them and so on. And I can remember whenever she'd sell an instrument, we'd have steak dinner at our house. So that shows you the level of prosperity in the household. We always had good food on the table. That was never a problem. But in the way of clothing, I had two little corduroy suits, and I would wear one, and then my mother would wash it and hang it out to dry, and it would freeze, you know, in the winter, freeze solid. But ice sublimes, incredibly, so it would dry out there even while frozen. And then I'd wear the other one for a week, and then switch back and forth. So one was green, this color, and one was bright red. So that was my two outfits in junior high school.
Were you involved in any clubs, activities, things like that in middle school and into high school?
I'm not remembering anything. We played volleyball at lunchtime at lunch hour, but that's the only thing extracurricular that I can remember from junior high. In high school, yeah, I got involved in a number of different things. We had a calculus club, for instance. Our mathematics teacher was wonderful. He had each year some kind of after school activity, and when I was a senior, he had this calculus club. And you know, he started from the very beginning. Have you studied calculus?
To a certain extent, okay. Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, he started from the very, very elementary and made us not just know how to use it, but understand why it worked the way it did, how it worked, what was inside it. So, I knew more calculus coming out of his calculus club than kids know from studying it in college. I guess kids study it in high school now, but back then it was
pretty rare.
So we went to the state math contest and won. And I went to the state Latin contest, won at that. I don't remember any other contests.
But no, they you know, read that when you were 17 years old, you built a telescope for...
I did, yeah. So that was for the science talent search that was run by Westinghouse back in that time. You had to write up a project. You had to do a project and then write it up and submit the paper. I got interested in telescope making, which means you start with a disc of glass and you turn that into a telescope mirror by grinding out the curve. Mm-hmm. You have to grind one piece of glass on the other. Then you use finer and finer grades of carbon on them. So you get a finer and finer finish on it. But the last step, you have to polish it. And for that, you use jeweler's rouge, which rather than grinding, it has sharp, sharp edges, and it shears away the glass. So you actually polish the thing to within a fraction of a wavelength of light. And I worked with the optical shop at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. There were a bunch of wacky kids like me making telescope mirrors there. And the director of the planetarium was interested in this and set up a Foucault testing device. This is a French guy's name. He devised a very nice little machine for testing your the curvature of your telescope mirror. It has to be not a sphere, which is the natural thing you tend to get when you grind, but it has to be corrected to be a parabola. The parabola, the property of the parabola is the parallel light waves coming in will be bent to a perfect focus in one point. With a sphere, if you put light out from this point to the mirror, it'll go back to the same place. That's what a sphere is perfect at. So it goes back to the same focus. But you need a parabola to take light from infinity, from the star. Mm-hmm. Focus that. So I learned all about that. And it was a Cassegrain telescope, which is not the simple kind that everybody else makes, but a more complex thing with a primary mirror that's a parabola, and it has a secondary mirror that's my brain has turned spongy and it won't keep the names of things. What do you call this thing with two foci? Hyperbola.
Concavely.
It's a convex mirror, yeah. Is it hyperbolic? Yeah, it's a hyperbola. It's what I was fishing for, yeah. So you take, there's a cone of rays coming from the, it comes from the infinity in, and it's going as though to a focus here, but you put this hyperbolic thing in here, and that is curved in such a way that it takes this cone, what would have been this cone, here's one focus of the hyperbola, and it has another focus over here. So it'll take that cone that was converging as though here and make it converge back there. So you get more amplification out of your telescope. So you can have a telescope tube that is physically this long, and it is making an image as though it were
much longer.
Much longer, yeah.
So you're doing, you know, the mathematics, astronomy, there's, you know, the sort of physics, even sort of a technical craft. Knowledge. Were you at the planetarium quite often?
I've been in on Sundays. I worked on Saturday to make the money to buy the train ticket to go work on the mirror on Sunday.
Where were you working?
The Retzel Jewelry Store in. We lived in Hinsdale, Illinois at that time. That's my high school years were in Hinsdale.
Okay.
Junior high, Elgin, Illinois, and we moved to Hinsdale. By now, Dad is more prosperous. They built a house. I had a real bedroom with my own closet, my own chest of drawers, and I had a barrel in my bedroom, which was filled with water halfway. To make it nice and heavy so that you could grind your mirror on it. So that's what I worked on my telescope mirror when I wasn't working in the planetarium.
So this is, it sounds like, astronomy was, a big interest at this time.
It's not astronomy. Okay, it only sounds like astronomy. Uh-huh. It's actually telescope making is the interest. I didn't take too much interest in astronomy using the thing, it was making it.
I see.
Understanding how it works, understanding how you need to manipulate it to get it to come out right.
It's more the device rather than how it's applied.
Yeah, somehow, yeah. So when I graduated, I got all these scholarships, but my dad was too prosperous for me to get any stipend. So my dad announced to me that I was not going to go to a private school that was good at optics and astronomy and all that. I was going to go to the University of Illinois. He had paid taxes in this damn state of Illinois, and I was going to go to the University of Illinois. So I did. And I started out as a physics major, and I presented myself to Mr. Peter Tull in 101 Observatory to ask for permission on the strength of my telescope building experience, permission to take astronomy 101, which you weren't allowed to take till you were a sophomore, you see. And he wouldn't let me in. He said, "Well, you don't know any calculus, for example. You need calculus." And I said, "Yes, I do." And I think he didn't believe me. So he didn't let me in. And I said, the hell with that. And I never took any astronomy.
Why do you think he was so, I guess, unsupportive? Or
I don't know. I looked like some prideful, cocky kid to him, probably. I don't know. I don't know why he did that.
What got so you started off as a physics major? How did you sort of get in, having that sort of initial decision? Was that based on interest you developed in high school?
Well, it was the closest thing to the optics. It looked like what I would like, but it turned out it wasn't. I fell asleep in physics lectures. Partly I had a decent high school physics course, and we knew it. Mm. And partly, I think the real thing is that you couldn't see to the edge of things. You couldn't see anything that we didn't know already. We already knew the whole universe, and they weren't teaching us about quantum phenomena or anything interesting like that. It was just, Newtonian physics. Mm-hmm. It was a bore. So I was taking chemistry because you had to, and I found that was very interesting. I could see some unknowns in chemistry, so I liked that better, and I switched my major. And it was not until after I graduated that I really got interested in biology. So I was a chemistry major. My training is chemistry, and my PhD is actually in chemistry. So I think that's not a bad thing to have a degree in one of the fundamental sciences rather than a degree in biotechnology. What does somebody know if they know biotechnology? You don't know anything. They don't know how to solve the problem because they don't know any of the fundamentals of whatever it is. I have a different way of looking at things than many of my colleagues. I think about things, quantitatively, and I think about the mechanism and so on. I'm better than some people, than many people at reasoning through what's going on when it isn't working. So I'm a pretty good problem solver, I think, in all modesty.
I think it's certainly a skill that's useful and difficult to have. What type of any particular things in chemistry that you were focused on during your undergrad years? Is it more general chemistry?
No, it was organic chemistry.
Okay.
I worked on anthracene photodimers, whatever they are, nice crystalline compounds with very elaborate, complex structures. But it was fun, it was interesting. Not useful, totally useless, I think. Interesting. And the chemistry department really encouraged its graduates to go elsewhere for graduate school, but I married a man who was already in graduate school there, so they decided to accept me just kind of provisionally as a graduate student and kind of see where it goes. And they started that year with cumulative exams rather than written exams for the PhD. So we took one exam per month. And I think each month a different professor would prepare the exam. And the rule was that you had to pass, what was it? You had to pass eight before you, I think there were four per year, and you had to pass eight before you failed 12. That is, you had 3 years in which you had to pass eight of these. It's some number like that, mm-hmm. similar to that, I don't remember precisely. So the first one was free. It didn't count. They give you one freebie just to get you through that. So I failed my first one, and then I passed eight in a row. And they weren't expecting that. They decided that I better stay for a PhD. So I did that.
Now, this sort of decision to go to graduate school, were you thinking as an undergrad that, you know, graduate school would be something that you were interested in?
Oh, yeah. There was never any question, of course. Yeah. What I was going to do with it, I don't think I clearly had a vision of that. I guess I was thinking I'd be a professor of something or other. The real thing is, I don't know, I was just doing what interested me and not being very practical-minded about where it was all going. I'm afraid I've been kind of like that throughout my career. I'm rather nearsighted. I do what's interesting at the moment without thinking, without planning too far ahead. But anyway.
It does, you find surprising and unexpected things. Your husband's name was Scott?
That was my first husband. No, Scott comes later.
Okay.
In the course of doing coursework for this PhD degree, they insisted that you have two minors. And I took one minor in biochemistry. The major was organic chemistry, so the minor was biochemistry. And I took a course that changed my life and career. It was called The Chemical Basis of Biological Specificity. And this course was taught by folks that we now know as luminaries in molecular biology. Benjamin Hall, Spiegelman, Nomura were all faculty members at Illinois at that time. And they taught a course that they told where we were on figuring out the genetic code and how you went about figuring out what it was, what were the first experiments to determine that, and how do we know what the sequence of the protein is, and what are the problems associated with determining that, and so on. And I learned about bacterial transformation, where you can take pure DNA and mix it with bacteria, and they can actually take it up and incorporate it into their chromosomal DNA. And I thought, that's phenomenal. So I was really fascinated by what the seeming brains of a DNA molecule. So I think that fascination has would describe everything that I've done since that time. DNA is somebody accused me one time that Mary Dell, anything the DNA does you think is interesting. That's the truth.
So. And just to get some time here, so you graduated with your BS in chemistry in 1960,
yeah.
And so this is the early 60s that,
yeah,
that
yeah.
This is.
62, 63, I'm taking this course. So I went to Suyoka is another one of the luminaries who taught that course. I went to Professor Suyoka and asked him, could I work in his lab on Saturdays and learn how to do this bacterial transformation? I love that. He was working on that. And he said, sure, come on in. So I did, and I worked with some of his postdocs and learned how to do these experiments. And he was the one, he said, you should go take the course at Cold Spring Harbor. And I said, what course? And so he told me about this course that they gave every summer. It lasted 4 weeks or 6 weeks or something. And they taught you all about how to do all these experiments. So he got me into the course, and I went and learned how to be a molecular biologist at that time.
Who was teaching the course?
Different people, again, the luminaries of the field, a lot of different people. And I went back, and I talked to Professor Ben Hall, who was in the chemistry department working with DNA. He was the only one. And I said, Dr. Hall, could I come and do my degree with you? He said, what do you want to work on? And I said, I want to do something with bacterial transformation. And he said, sure, we can do that. And so I did that. And then he said, but by the way, I'm leaving. He said, I'm going to Seattle. And I said, fine, let's go. So in the summer of 63, I think it was, we moved to Seattle, and I finished my degree at Illinois, but in absentia. And I got the degree not until 1967, I think. I finished it in 66, but they didn't award the degree until 67. But it took a little longer because of the move and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved to out of a chemistry department into a genetics department. That was a huge culture change. And everything was much more biological. I learned some genetics from that, of course. And I published two papers on bacterial transformation, and one more as a postdoc. I published a third one. And from there went on to do a postdoc at the University of Washington, still, with Brian McCarthy. He was in the microbiology department. So it's a lot of department skipping, if you look at my career. And that is really the nature of, DNA is a very interdepartmental subject. It has applications everywhere, and you have to know a lot of different stuff to work successfully with it and to do meaningful experiments. Okay, you've got to ask me some more questions. I'm getting stuck.
How was, just sort of the, not only, you're switching departments, you're moving from chemistry to genetics to microbiology. What about the change in location of moving out to Seattle from Illinois?
Oh, yeah, Seattle was wonderful after Illinois. I learned how to ski. In Ben Hall's lab, we decreed that Wednesday was Saturday, and Saturday was Wednesday. So we went skiing, not on the weekend when it was crowded, but on Wednesday when we could have the slopes to ourselves. And I got to be a pretty fair skier during that time, and hiker, and so on and so on.
Were you able to, keep up at all with your, love of horses? Is that...
No horses.
No horses.
It's sad in a way. Now I'm in a place where I could have a horse, but I have a bad back and it's get right. Wow.
Let's see, so you, this is around moving into the early 1970s. You have your postdoc fellowship. You're a research associate in the Department of Microbiology at this time?
Yes, yeah. And in the meantime, we have shed husband number one, and I married Scott. And by now, I think it's about that time we were having our children, 2 years apart. And I guess after Mark, the second one, was born, I was at home looking after him and trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. Mm-hmm. And Helen Whiteley in the microbiology department called me up and said, Mary Dell, would you come and help me teach this laboratory course? And I said, sure. I was just delighted. It was a toe in the door there. And it was in the process of teaching that course, one of my students was interested in a paper about crown gall disease, and that was my first introduction to this agrobacterium story.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that Gene Nestor was planning to write a grant application to study the crown gall disease. So I went down to Gene's office and talked with him, and I said, look, I know how to do DNA experiments to see what's going on with this thing, whether there's DNA transfer from agrobacterium to the plant cells or not. I said, the publications that exist on this are not right, they're not good. They're not well controlled, and I don't believe them.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but they're impossible. They're they violate thermodynamics. There were claims that that tumor DNA would bind better with agrobacterium DNA than agrobacterium DNA itself would bind to agrobacterium DNA. And that's just not possible. No way. Anyway.
Who was the student that...
Tom Currier. Let's see, is that true? Yeah, I think it was Tom. Yeah. Yeah. So he was the first graduate student on this project, actually. I wrote the grant application, and because I didn't have any status, I couldn't submit it. So Gene signed it and sent it in. And we got the money. We got the money from two sources. We could only accept one. Mm-hmm. So we did.
Who offered the money, and who did you accept?
American Cancer Society was one, and let's see, who was the other? National Science Foundation, I guess, was the other. I think that's right. And we took, I think we took the American Cancer Society money, because it looked more renewable. Mm-hmm. So that was my salary. I got a job. I got my own job.
How is it? You know, I know you know you're having your children now. How is it? You know, sort of managing the home and work life, especially now as you get the grant application accepted and are teaching and so on.
It was hard. I decided. I made I actually articulated this to myself. What I was going to do is, when I was with the kids, I was going to be with the kids and not think about the lab. And when I was in the lab, I was not going to think about the kids. It was just as simple as that. And I told the boys when they were, when they got to an age where they could begin to understand it, 5 years old or so, I told them that I was the kind of mom who would go crazy if I couldn't do my work. I loved my work, and I needed to do it. And they didn't want a crazy mom, did they? No, they didn't want a crazy mom. So I said, well, that's the price you have to pay. So I will not be with you all the time. You will go to babysitters. But I will be with you when I'm with you. So that was the deal that I made with the boys. And they seem to have turned out pretty well. One is the mayor of Carrboro, and he's now running for a Senate seat that's come open in the state.
Wow.
Senate. Not bad. And both of them went to law school and passed the bar exam.
Great.
So, yeah, they're good kids. Good kids.
And now I know Rob Yeah, so he's coming into the story. How did he begin to, begin to recognize and become aware of his work?
Okay, well, Rob Skilperud published some of this early work that I told you was impossible. So we knew his name. And I think sometime around here, Gene Nestor had a sabbatical come up, and he spent his sabbatical in Skilperud's lab, trying to learn something about Crown Gall from Skilperud and trying to understand what the hell he was doing that got these bizarre results. So he made good friends with Rob, and we got long telexes back and forth at this time. And the story of the science here is beginning to be quite interesting, competitive. So do you want to get into that now?
Yeah, certainly.
Are we finished with me?
we'll continue to go back and forth, but yeah, if we could, I know there's going to be some races here, some competitions, some lots of problems to figure out. If you could go ahead. And...
Okay, well, these will be the facts as I remember them, and different people have different. Memories. Mine are right.
And theirs
are wrong. what to give Rob Skilperud his due, he wrote his PhD thesis on this subject of the crown gall, and he did some of these DNA hybridization experiments. What you do is you bind the DNA from the tumor cell to cellulose nitrate membrane filter. It's not a southern blot, but it works sort of like a southern blot, except that the DNA isn't separated into bands. It's just a blob of all the DNA. And you soak that in radio-labeled agrobacterium DNA, and then you wash all the unreacted agrobacterium DNA away, and you count the membrane, click, 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 and some counts stick to it. The control that he didn't do was to take that same DNA and put it with radio-labeled E. coli or radio-labeled some other, any other kind of DNA. If he had done that, he would have found that there's something in his tumor DNA that will bind to anything.
So you're sort of getting false positives.
Yeah. It's dirty. It's full of polysaccharide that tends to co-purify with DNA. And unless you take great pains to get rid of that, you get artifacts. So that was not a good way to do the experiment. We did what you call model mixture experiments, where we took tobacco leaf DNA, which you can get pretty pure. There's not a whole lot of starch in the tobacco leaf. Not the way they were working with these tumor cells that grow up with tissue culture like this. This is callus form of growth, and the tumor cells wouldn't regenerate back to a real plant.
Just the callus.
Yeah. That was one of the challenges of the genetic engineer, was to figure out why it would grow like this and not turn back into a plant. So when you make DNA from that stuff, it is full of slimy polysaccharides and things that cause these artifacts. So we made leaf DNA, which was pure, didn't have all that slime in it. And then we mixed in 1%, 0.1%, 0.01% of agrobacterium DNA, and we measured how fast the radioactivity would bind to this, and it bound with linear kinetics. It didn't all jump on the way the tumor DNA did. And we looked at how much we could see. Okay, and it turned out you had to have, I can't remember my numbers here, but I needed to have about 1%, or maybe it was down to 0.1%, but you couldn't see really tiny trace amounts of agrobacterium DNA if it were there. You couldn't see it by this method. It wasn't sensitive. So we did that kind of, we did every control. And what we found is that the method really was not powerful enough to answer the question. And so I knew about how to work with DNA in solution, not stuck to filters, and to measure the renaturation kinetics of DNA. And so I designed what we call the driver DNA experiment. And it works like this. You take a low concentration of labeled agrobacterium DNA, and you measure its renaturation rate. That is, you take the strands apart, Watson from Crick, and you cook them at 60 or 65 degrees, depending on the salt, and it'll go back together and renature. And there's a test you can do to tell what's single stranded and what's double stranded. So you can measure the kinetics of this. I told you that I think about things in a kinetic quantitative way. This is an example. Okay, so the experiment is, we know that if you double the DNA concentration, that reaction will go four times as fast. And if you double it again, and again go four times as fast. So it's concentration dependent. So the reasoning is this, that if the tumor DNA had copies of agrobacterium DNA in it, then when we add tumor DNA to this mixture, it should denature faster. And exactly how much faster, we should be able to tell from the rate. So you do a positive control. And we did an experiment like that, and it said, absolutely not, it's not here. So we published a paper saying, well, sorry, it wasn't there. And then...
Ren, what year was that?
DNAS paper, I don't remember. I can find that out for you, but I don't remember. If we look on my curriculum vitae, you know, my publication list is there somewhere. It won't be there. We don't reference that. That's really old stuff. In Jeff Schell and Mark Van Montague's lab, that's the Mark Van Montague of the award, they found, looking for something else, they found by accident that there were these huge circular DNAs in agrobacterium. They were looking for a virus that they were working on, and they found these huge circular DNAs that had to be a plasmid. And we knew about small plasmids. We had looked for small plasmids in agrobacterium. We knew from a bunch of biology that I have written about, and I haven't talked with you about. Do you want the whole lecture? I'll give you the paper, and you can get it from there. I wrote a memoir in plant physiology. Maybe you've seen a copy of that. Do you?
Yeah,
is that what that is?
Yes, this is the memoir. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so that has some of the history of why we thought there had to be some kind of something transferred to the plant cells. So we were trying to figure out how the crown gall works, how it is that the bugs change the way those plant cells grow forever.
Could you maybe speak about just this sort of phenomenon of continuous growth and how that differed from other materials?
Yeah, I was trying to skip over some of this for brevity, but you don't want any brevity here. Okay, well, the deal was, this goes back to where the problem was when we came on the scene. The deal was that we knew that agrobacterium caused these tumors, that if you wounded the plant cell and put the bacteria into the wound, that an outgrowth would occur. And we knew that the cells of this outgrowth made some strange chemistry that the natural plant didn't make. And the chemistry was named octopine because it was already a known compound in octopus. So it was called octopine. And if you used a different strain of agrobacterium, you might get a nobiline tumor, or we now know a list of these opine-type compounds. They are simple. They're made from one amino acid and one keto acid or one sugar, typically. So they're nutritionally good stuff. And it turns out that an octopine strain of agrobacterium not only makes an octopine tumor, but it has the ability to break down octopine and use it as a sole source of carbon and nitrogen. So the reasoning is that apparently the purpose of the gall from the point of view of agrobacterium, the purpose is it's making a storehouse of food that it can eat and other bacteria cannot. Nothing else can eat it.
So no one else can be, or nothing else can be really be drawn from that as an energy source.
Yeah. And this is a slight oversimplification. There are, in fact, a few Pseudomonas bacteria in nature that have figured out how to eat this, or maybe they knew for other reasons. I've slightly oversimplified it, but basically the story is that it's a unique carbon source for agrobacterium, carbon and nitrogen. Okay, so, and what we knew is that the plant cells, if you cut them off this gall, cut them out of the gall, and surface sterilize them, that is, dip them in alcohol and set them on fire, and then take a sterile scalpel and cut some tissue out of the middle of this and put it on an agar medium such as I just showed you. The cells would grow under conditions where normal plant cells would grow. Little plant cells require some hormones, some auxin and some cytokinin in order to grow. Auxin is the elongation factor, cytokinin is the cell division factor. So you gotta get bigger and you gotta divide in order to make this gall. So Agrobacterium prudently has learned how to transform a cell to make something it wants and at the same time make that cell grow furiously fast. So it's pretty clever when you think about it. And the thing is, how did the Agrobacterium do that? And the speculation was must be putting something in there. Ermin Brown studied this for decades in New York City. Help me out. What am I trying to say? The Rockefeller University. And he was kind of the godfather of this field, long before we came into it. So he named this the tumor-inducing principle, this thing, whatever it was, that Agrobacterium gave to the plant cells. And the speculation, one would conclude that it had to be some self-replicating thing, because the plant cells remembered this alteration forever. They never went back. You could grow a whole house full of them, and every cell still had the ability to keep growing and growing. So the obvious candidate would be some kind of DNA, maybe some kind of RNA, maybe some kind of virus, maybe some kind of plasmid. You know, it's a short list of things that would behave like that. But then there was another camp that thought, well, maybe Agrobacterium is just flipping some kind of switch in the plant cells that takes them from quiescent to grow furiously. And in the course of doing that, all these other things happen. So there was that school of thought.
Who was pursuing that approach?
Well, there wasn't much you could do with that approach. I mean, you could look for things. I knew how to look for things, but it's not clear how you look for that. I didn't really believe that. I thought probably something was transferred. But on the other hand, I don't know. The story as it eventually began to emerge was so amazing that I could hardly believe it. But we'll get there. We'll get there. So it was this perplexing story. You know, what is the tumor-inducing principle? That was what made us trouble ourselves to look for this. We knew that if there was a way to put something in the plant cell that would stay there, that the possibility was we could do that too. But that's a big if.
What years, or period were this, because I know that, really the sort of rDNA possibility that's, 73, 74, where that's kind of becoming known, restriction endonucleases and things like that are
becoming
available.
Yeah. It was, I'm thinking late 60s, does that sound right? No, that doesn't sound right. Let's see, 56 was when I graduated from high school. 67 is when I got my PhD degree. So it's 70. It's early 70s is when the recombinant DNA technology was coming along.
Yeah.
Early 70s, yes.
And were you keeping up with things like were coming out of Herbert Boyer, Stan Cohen, Paul Berg's labs?
That's what I'm saying. That was just that was research and word of mouth. And beginning to be published.
And up here in 74, that Ivo Zanin.
Zanin, yeah, yeah.
Tell me about that breakthrough in Sheldon Montague's lab.
Okay, I was just getting to that, and that's when we jumped back.
Oh, sorry.
That's fine. Okay, so Zainan was the student who found this gigantic circular thing when he was looking for a virus, and Sheldon and Van Montague, I think, quickly recognized that that might be the tumor-inducing principle. So they looked in aviary-like strains of Agrobacterium that didn't cause galls, and they didn't see these big plasmids. So they thought that the plasmid was the cause. And the word came through the telex to our lab in Seattle that there were plasmids. And a little bit about how to see them. There were two experiments you could do to see them. One was to lyse the bacteria gently and put it on a gradient, an alkaline sucrose gradient, I saw in the way, and spin it just the right amount, and you could see a band of DNA moving down the gel. And the other experiment was a cesium chloride gradient, where the DNA would band in a high concentration of cesium chloride. That's separating the plasmid on the basis that it's a closed circular configuration rather than linear DNA like the chromosome. And you stuff ethidium bromide into it, and it changes the density of the circles differently than the density of the linear chromosomal fragments. So you separate it, there it is. So once we knew that, once we knew how to detect this, we had a lot of material on hand. Gene had Alice Montoya, who was one of the people in his lab. She was his technician. He had had her doing Kerr crosses, where you mix two bacteria together in a sunflower plant, a wound. And it turned out that you could actually get transfer of virulence from a virulent strain to an avirulent strain. But one didn't know what virulence was at that time. But now we had the transfer strain and the mother strain. We could look in there and we could see that there's a plasmid here and there wasn't in the avirulent. And when you did the Kerr cross and virulence transferred, you could see the plasmid. So we were quickly able to. Yeah, it took a week or 10 days to get all these data. So we knew that the plasmid was right. We knew that the plasmid was indeed the agent of the tumor. Within a week of getting that information, I would say. So immediately we knew that we wanted to do one of these driver DNA experiments. The kind we had done with the whole Agrobacterium, we wanted to do that with this plasmid. That was what we should be looking for. So we set up to do that. One of these experiments required everybody in the lab, and the radio labeled DATP, I think, that we bought from New England Nuclear would come on Thursday, and we would use it to make radio-labeled test DNA, whatever it was, Agrobacterium or now the plasmid. And then we would have to work hard the entire weekend, and about Monday noon or Monday afternoon, the experiment would be finished. But everybody in the lab worked day and night over that weekend to do one of these. We had to work fast because the probe was so hot that it would sort of suicide destroy itself because of the radiation. It's not radiation that would harm us, you understand. It's radiation that it breaks the backbone of the DNA molecules. And these are pretty big DNA molecules. So we did that experiment with the plasmid, and it said no. Not there. And so we sat back on our haunches and decided to give up, more or less. And then I got feeling guilty because we had promised the American Cancer Society that we would do an experiment to take the plasma apart into specific pieces and look for those one by one if we didn't see the whole plasma in there. And Gene said, he denies this, but I remember he said, we don't have to do that, you know. I mean, just because we proposed it, you know, if in our judgment that's not a worthwhile experiment, then it's, you know, it's very unlikely to succeed. We can decide to put the money more productively. And I said, well, we really have to do that. We have to put this to rest, one way or the other. We have to do it. You know, we won't really be finished with this. So we did. And this time, we found it. We found that two of the fragments that we separated from this tumor-inducing plasmid, as we now call it, two of the fragments were in the plant cells. So all the other fragments said no, and these two said yes.
Wow. Now, is this did this require sort of the same sort of intense sort of over the weekend all the team?
Yeah. That's what it took. Yeah.
How many people were on the team doing that work?
How many people are in that picture? Six or seven?
Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Yeah, that's how many.
Right. So just for the recording, or if you want to,
the real worker bees are these. Those guys they went out for pizza. And Milt had the stopwatch. He was the timekeeper. Martin Grumman's job was making the radio-labeled DNA. And Don Merlo's job was getting the DNA out of the agarose so that we could do the experiment with it. To do that, he invented a thing that he called the cow, for reasons that you can imagine. You put your agarose slice, you cut out your fragment from the gel, so it's a little block of agarose, and you put it in a dialysis bag and tie the ends very tightly. So you have a number of dialysis bags, each with one of the fragments in it, and you put it into an electrical field, and that will chase the DNA out of the agarose, and it'll be there in the end of the bag. Mm-hmm. And you take the bag off this cow.
So this kind of multiple stomachs.
Yeah.
Here. And just to go through the rest of the team here.
Let's see, I cut the gel. I masterminded the whole layout, purification of the DNA. All the glassware that we used had to be fired in a self-cleaning oven to be sure that when we did find something, it was there and not contamination from previously unclean glassware or mm-hmm. something. And all of us ran the columns to analyze the single-stranded or double-stranded DNA. And we had to do this, you know, with logarithmically increasing time. So we'd start with 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 40 seconds. And the time got further and further apart, but we had a lot of samples. And I didn't put any graphs in this, did I? But
yeah. Okay, so I see the timekeeper. That's sort of getting the
In the beginning, the timekeeping was tight.
And this is the you have to label here the brute force experiment.
Exactly, yes.
The brute force of just because want to explain why it was referred to as the brute force experiment.
Well, we wouldn't have thought of it as a brute force experiment, except that we now do southern blots, which are quite a bit easier, and give, in fact, more information. It's a huge effort. It's a huge effort. Nobody does those experiments anymore.
But then, you know, that's because you have alternative tools that are just much easier. Now this was the paper that was published in 1977 in the journal Cell?
I think so, yeah.
And were there any, interesting anecdotes of, something dropping and breaking, or, you're running out getting pizza, trying to do this, crazy thing over a weekend?
There are a couple of stories worth mentioning. One is that the people involved came to work on Tuesday morning, and we all kind of sat around and looked at each other, and even though we were working at our normal pace, we all felt like we were going backwards. We had worked so hard on the weekend that it felt like standing still when you were. And the other thing is, Alice Montoya came here to work for we were Siva Gagi then, but. Yeah, she and I reminisced about this, and whenever I encountered any of the other people in that picture, we would reminisce about how that time was. It felt good to have a collaboration like that. It was, we've kind of gone through life, all of us, looking for that high again, and we've never found it. But it was there was an intimacy to being a part of that, that machine. That did a brute force experiment. So I tell that to kids, that the surprise of my career maybe was how important it is to be able to collaborate like that, and to be able to invest trust in your co-workers. We all had to trust each other to do that right.
Someone's not, accidentally, contaminating something, or doing something, that might not let the experiment work.
Yeah, you had to do things very precisely, very carefully, very much on time, and if one did slip up, report it. So yeah, it's an act of trust. It's always an act of trust when you collaborate directly with anybody on anything, but with so many people. Yeah.
How do you all celebrate? You finally get the positive results. Did you go out for a beer or?
I don't remember.
Let's see. That's a. So, papers published in 1977. I definitely want to come back more to the science also. But in 79, you become an associate professor of biology. How was that shift made of becoming a tenure track professor as opposed to research associate?
I moved to Washington University in St. Louis. And the reason I moved was not because I wanted to, but Gene Nestor made it necessary for me to go. He became angry with me over stuff. One thing that made him angry, I think that probably kicked off the whole thing, was told me not to look for RNA in the plant cells coming from this DNA that's in there. And I said, oh, it's got to be there. I mean, what do you think that DNA is doing in there? Of course, it's got to make its RNA so it can make octopine or whatever. And so I went ahead and did the experiment anyway, and it was there, of course. Mm-hmm. I told Burton Drummond, we could see a signal with the RNA on the southern blots. And I told Martin, could you do this again and clean up the RNA by this and that method so that we can get a nice, clean, pretty picture for publication? I said, if you can do that, you could be first author in the paper. And so he did. and I wrote up the paper, and I had Martin's name first and my name last, and we had Milt Gordon in there because he made the tumor DNA, or made the tumor tissue, callus tissue for us, and maybe somebody else, I don't remember. And Gene Nestor got wind of this, that that paper existed, and he came to me and said, I should be the senior author of that paper. And I said, no, you shouldn't. You told me not to do it. I said, I'm the senior author. He said, you be the first author. I said, no, Martin Drummond was promised first author if he did the experiment, and he did. And so finally I said, well, I will make a compromise. I'll put your name on the paper. And I did. But that was the beginning of the end. He was really furious.
And putting the name on it would be because it's the work being done in his lab. Now, why was he, I guess not wanting to, be searching for the RNA? You know, because like you said, it seems to make sense that.
I don't know. He wanted to spend a whole bunch of money on some other project that I thought didn't make any sense. I mean, it made sense, but it wasn't going to work, technically.
So I guess that, working with limited resources, there's only so many things that can be investigated. How did come across this position at Washington University? Were you applying widely?
Yeah. And they weren't looking for people particularly, but I was invited there to give a mini symposium talk, and I think they liked what they heard, and when. A friend of mine, a colleague from graduate school, was a microbiology professor at Wash U, and he said to me, the chairman of the biology department told me that if you would send him a letter of application, that he would invite you for an interview. And so I did, and they liked it. Yeah, that was the beginning of a happy little interlude at Washington University.
So it seems like that you're happy with your new colleagues there. Who were some of the people that that were in the department or that you were working with? I know that it's your DNA, so it's all types of different departments.
Yeah, there were snake people and bat people and all kinds of things. But the plant biology program was quite strong, and I fitted very nicely into that. Virginia Walbutt was in there. Joe Varner was the head of the program, and there were several lady faculty members. Sally Elgin was one. And I'm having great trouble remembering names now. Anyway, it was a very strong bunch of people. One of them told the story that they were in Washington, D.C. at a committee meeting, and somebody said to her, gee, don't you have any men in your department? Is your whole department women? And she responded, well, all the funded ones are. Which was half true. Maybe more than half. Yeah, we had some very strong women.
That's kind of interesting. I think especially at this time that actually having as they remarked, so many women. What was it like sort of being a woman in this what had been a in many ways male-dominated field? It's it's only the late 70s at this point.
I don't know. I really I'm not tuned into that. I'm not conscious of that. I mean, it was nice having female colleagues, yeah. Mm-hmm. But they were doing their thing, and I was doing mine. And my real hero was the head of the program, which was Joe Varner, a man, and the head of the department who hired me, also a man. So I like them. They're nice.
I guess it was more, you know, facing, you know, just unequal treatment, you know, that different standards would be applied.
What I noticed moving to Washington University is that everybody was helping me and pushing me along and raising me up instead of stepping on my fingers the way they seemed to do at the University of Washington.
Now, were you beginning?
I had been a second-class citizen, maybe third-class, at the University of Washington. You know, I didn't have a tenure-track faculty position. I was nobody.
So that was probably, you know, the hard part there. Did you have any graduate students when you were at University of Washington?
Sort of yes and no. I certainly mentored what students that we had, but they weren't my students. They were Gene Nestor's students. Francine Eden was one. Oh yeah, and I had another renegade student come work with me. Her advisor went on sabbatical for a year, and she came over, and she was one of the early denizens of the Chilton Hilton, I guess. Her name was Daniela Shockey, and she's in that picture, actually, of the seven of us. Yeah, Danny came to work on DNA, to work on the agrobacterium problem with us, and she kept on, she stayed on even after her advisor came back. So they added me onto her committee at Washington State University. That's where her degree was from. So I didn't have any real students of my own, no.
And so how did that change? You know, I want to get back to this, if you could, you know, maybe speak of this, the Chilton Hilton, so you're moving to Washington University. So now you have your own graduate students. Is that,
Yeah,
and tell me about, you know, how was, you know, what was your mentoring style? It, you know, it's, from what I've read, you know, very supportive, you know, often, you know, not necessarily what you would find among other professors. How would you interact with your graduate students?
Well, what I would do is a lot of them were postdocs rather than students, but anyway, same story either way. I would ask them what, you know, where they were going, what they wanted to learn, what kind of experiment they wanted to learn how to do, and try to fit the project, you know, choose the project so that it fit that mold. How long do you want to be here? Where do you want to publish? Do you want an easy project or a chancy one that's more high profile? That kind of stuff. Because I wanted people to get out of the experience what they wanted. So Marge Rula, now Marge Matsky, who was she was not my most productive postdoc, shall I say, but was by far the most creative. You know, I recognize this. She's fantastic. She read widely, and she was full of ideas. And, she married another of my postdocs, Tony Natsky, and they went off to Austria, and she's become world famous now. She's very much in demand. She'll probably get a Nobel, I don't know. But she was one of the first to discover co-suppression of one gene by another in transgenic stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, she's just amazing.
Now, the Chilton Hilton, is that, you know, having, you know, graduate students and postdocs over to your house?
No, it's the homeless came and found a home there. So Daniela, who wanted to work in the lab for a time, lived with us for a time. Hmm. She finally got an apartment of her own, I think, the second year or so. But she liked the little boys, the dogs and the cats. We liked watching the medical sudsers on TV at night. But most of the denizens of the Chilton Hilton were French students. They were foreign students who came kind of penniless and had the opportunity to work and learn without too much expense of living. Scott was a Fulbright student when he graduated from college, and I think he was invested in the idea of paying that back to others and got a great deal out of that experience himself.
And did Scott came with you. Did he get a position in the microbiology department at Washington University?
In the biology department. Biology. It was all biology. They gave him a position. It wasn't a faculty position, but whatever it was, he was a visiting professor or something. It was funny. They built him a nice little lab with a big fume hood for his machinery, for his electrophoresis equipment. He was a big asset to our program, actually. He worked on the opines.
Okay, so the energy source. Now, when you go to Washington University, and this is the time where you begin to be focusing on the tumor-inducing plasmids.
The disarming of the TI plasmid, yeah. Yeah.
And in what do you, how are they disarmed? What's the logic behind having to disarm the tumor-inducing plasmids, the T plasmids?
Well, we figured that there were a bunch of genes that were known after a while. There are still genes on there that we don't know what they are, but the auxin gene and the cytokinin gene were mapped out. Were beginning to be mapped out. But we disarmed the plasmid. I would say we disarmed it first, quite by accident. We made an insertion into the TI plasmid at a place that was convenient and easy to get into, so that's why we chose it. But it turned out to be the soft spot. It turned out that inactivated the cytokinin gene. And that turned out to be the one that you had to inactivate in order for plant cells to be able to regenerate to a plant. Nobody knew that until we did that, but there it is, it worked. So just by luck, we engineered and, we published the first paper describing how to put a gene into tDNA with transgenes. And the example we chose was, in fact, the disarmed plasmid, as we discovered later.
Without disarming it, it would just remain callous.
Turns into a callous, yeah. Yeah, if the hormone mix in the plant cells is not natural, then it can't differentiate. But if you mess around with the hormones, then there's a certain range that it can tolerate and be able to regenerate. So the amount of auxin that this strain, this agrobacterium strain, was producing in its tumor cells, the amount of auxin was not excessive, but the amount of cytokinin was. And if we once knocked out the cytokinin, then the auxin could be tolerated. Allow regeneration.
Now, the other part of it is really mapping out the tumor-inducing plasmid of the different regions for example, the virulence region that allows it to to actually make the transfer.
Yes, yeah. We didn't work on that significantly. Others were doing that. There were a number of groups. I mean, the people were graduating out of Gene's master's lab and going out and setting up islands of crown gall study here and there. So, and you know, we there are, I don't know, four or five of them in the United States now that are second generation friends. They're good friends. We have crown gall meetings each year and I see all my friends.
That picture on the wall behind you, that.
These guys?
Yeah,
that's a crown gall conference, yeah.
Okay, so that's the 30th annual crown gall conference.
Yeah.
And that was in 2009?
Yes.
So you're in contact with these people that are coming out of Nestor's lab, that are, you know, sort of working on?
Yeah, we're friends. I founded that conference when I moved from Seattle to St. Louis because I felt like Seattle was giants. You know, they had a big machine, a lot of money, and you know, we little guys out here on our own having to compete with that. We should band together and talk to each other and help each other to the extent possible. So that was my idea in starting this conference. Let the students do the presenting and the experience. And we'll have it in local regions so that people can drive a carload of students to the union. So it's kind of expanded from that vision over the 33 or whatever it is years. But that was the concept anyway in the beginning.
So 1979 was the first conference. Where did you hold it?
It was at Northwestern University. And what was their name? The Lippincotts were there. They were early in the field, and they've kind of aged out, I guess. I think they retired. But they hosted that first meeting.
About how many people were there?
25, I don't know.
Okay, it's pretty substantial.
And wherever you go, of course, all the local students will come, so they'll swell the attendance.
So now they're, figuring out the different components of the T plasmid. It's still a matter, though, of really being able to transfer the gene successfully and then regenerate the plant that's been transformed.
So this is
early 1980s that you're working on this problem. And I think in 82 when you succeed.
You're asking me.
I'm just making sure that I have the. Well, I guess moving on.
It's 83. Yeah, 83 is the year of the Miami Winter Symposium. Yeah. Yes.
Well, let's talk about leading up to that. What were you doing? Attempting to basically get these transgenic plants to work.
Well, lots of different things. One effort was, and this was, these things were all going on in all the different labs that were, it was going on at Monsanto, and Shell and Dan Montague were working on it at the same time, and we were, to get an antibiotic resistance marker that would work in the plant, kanamycin resistance. So to get a gene that's not a plant gene to work in a plant, you need to put a plant active promoter and terminator on the beginning and end of the coding region. And then you need to be able to transfer that somehow to the plant cell with the agrobacterium. One of the problems was that the TI plasmid is so big that to put a gene into it is extremely difficult. And one of the early discoveries that that we made, and Skilfrud's lab also worked on this at the same time, in competition, we asked whether you could put the tDNA, the genes to be transferred, on a separate little plasmid and put that in there with the helper genes, with the virulence genes on the TI plasmid. And would that still be able to move the tDNA? And that worked. So that made everything easier. You could work with your transgenes on a little plasmid. You could add your antibiotic resistance marker or whatever you wanted to test into the little plasmid, and then put it into Agrobacterium with a helper plasmid. So that's technology that we use all the time now.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier. So yeah, the mini TI plasmid was one thing that we were working on, and we were working on the gene promoter from the multiple synthase gene, so that we could attach that, figure out where the end of it was, and attach that to an antibiotic resistance marker or whatever else we wanted to express in the plant. It all sounds so easy now, but yeah, it just had never been done.
What were, I know that it eventually was a tobacco plant that was successful. Were you working with other plants also?
Not much. No. And even tobacco was hard enough. I collaborated with my friend Andrew Binns at Penn. He was very experienced at plant cell culture, and he was the one who took our engineered Agrobacterium strain. I said to him, We have the problem with this, we made this nice plasmid with a potential transgene in it, but we can't get the plant cells to grow. And so he said, sure, send it out. And so we got him the Agrobacterium strain, and he worked with it for several weeks or a month, and called me up and he said, well, the reason that it didn't grow for you is that the plant cells, you got to supplement it with cytokinin. And I said, aha, we hit the cytokinin gene, I'll be darned. And then he called me back a few weeks or a month later, and he said, Barry Dell, they're making plants. And I said, oh. I said, yeah. I said, well, Andrew, what you have is the first genetically engineered plants. They weren't mutants. It wasn't just one plant, but the whole petri dish was full of little plants. They were all here. So that's when we knew we had it. So those plants got their picture on the cover of Cell. Printed backwards, as I recall. It's okay. The point still comes.
Now, there's certainly, competition. You have, Ernie Jaworski at Monsanto,
mm-hmm.
And of course, Shell and Van Montague in Belgium. Science is a very competitive field. You know, there's often not much reward for second place. Were you guys in contact with one another? Were you sharing or kind of keeping maybe showing one card but keeping the rest to your vest?
I certainly tried to be as open as possible, but I wasn't totally, completely open with the Monsanto folks, because I sensed already that we had a little problem with competition. You know, when I suggested that we could do such and such, they would ask me, well, write us a proposal. You know, how would you do it? And so I would write it in as cryptic a way as I could without, you know, totally enabling them to do it for me. But in the case of our competition with Scoperoot's bunch, they had an Agrobacterium strain that had the virulence genes, but not the tDNA. They had made that in the course of doing something else, just it's a natural deletion mutant of the plasmid. And that was exactly the strain that we needed in order to test the mini-TI idea. Would it work in trans to help the genes? And they had published it, you know, 10 years earlier. So I pulled them up and wrote to them and asked for this thing. And I had to tell them why. And they wrote back that they had to tell me that they were working on the same thing. And I kind of think we came to some agreement. They honorably did send me the mutant screen. But we published together. There was another case of that kind of thing where I had done the same work that Jeff Skellis' group had done. And we held back, we sat on our publication until theirs was ready, and then we published them together.
Now we're kind of leading up here to the Miami Winter Symposium, where all of the different groups are presenting on these results. Mm-hmm. How did the symposium get put together? How was it? What was the logistics of sort of deciding that this would come together?
I don't rightly know. I think we were invited, but I think if you felt you had a story, you could invite yourself. Somebody did invite himself onto that program, but most of us were invited speakers. I'm trying to remember who it is that was the that invited himself in. We'll come back to you. But in a way, it doesn't matter. I was not too happy with it at the time. No competition.
What was the experience like at the symposium? It kind of seems like all this, really sort of hard work and it seemed, for many of these groups is finally sort of, it's we did it.
Yeah, my perception is that all the tools were basically in hand. Each piece of the project. We hadn't put it all together in one beautiful experiment, but all this, each problem had been solved. So you could see that it was going to work. We were going to be able to make transgenic plants with efficiency. We had made the plants, and we had the progeny, but we hadn't done it efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
We had done it the hard way, the brute force way.
Did you share some sort of war stories with some of the other participants in terms of the difficulties that were encountered, considering how tough it was?
You mean since or at that time?
Or at that time?
I can't remember. I don't think so.
Well, 1983 is also the year that you made the switch from academia into the private sector. And I know that, this is only the very beginning where, at least in the biosciences, where, academics are becoming involved in private industry, there's still some you know, it's not the really the norm. Some people, you know, felt that it was, you know, harming the purity of science. How did you feel about making that move?
Well, I would say that it wasn't such early days. In fact, it seemed like most of my friends had already been hired away by industry. And symbolic of that, you know, when Cedar-Geigy decided to make a move into biotechnology, the only leader they found left was me, a woman, for heaven's sake. Well, it must have been a culture shock to them.
So they sought you out.
They sought me out.
And what was their pitch that they gave to you?
They said that they were going to set up a lab in North Carolina. And I like North Carolina, having grown up here. And they indicated something of how big it would be for the beginning, at least. And how they were looking for a leader for this. And finally, would I be interested in making myself a nominee? And I said, sure, why not? So I went home and talked with Scott about it. And he said, go for it. That is, we had both sets of parents near here. His parents were in Virginia, and mine were in Southern Pines. So they weren't getting any younger at that time. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like a good idea to be a little closer to them.
Was he able to find work relatively easy out here too?
No, not easy. But it worked out.
You're at Cedar-Geigy Core. I have here from 1983 to 1993. What were some of the initial products or projects that you started working on once you came aboard?
Well, we had to solve a number of fundamental problems. One of them was getting BT to work in plants. Everybody was working on that. And another one was how to transform corn, maize, and how to transform soybean. You see, the problem is that Cedar-Geigy hired a tobacco expert, and they weren't in the tobacco business. And I didn't know anything about corn or soybeans. So we had a big gulf to reach in order to get anything done. I had no idea how hard that would be, especially transforming corn was awful.
What makes corn more difficult than, say, transforming tobacco?
It's a bitch. I don't know. I think a developmental biologist would probably have a word describing that. You know, it's more like a stem cell. The tobacco plant is more like a stem cell. It regenerates easily, and corn absolutely is not like that. There are some plants, potato for instance, you can cut the eye out of a potato and make a whole new plant out of it. And bananas are propagated like that. And in fact, these crops are not bred at all, they are propagated. And then other plants are, you have a seed business.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed a hybrid seed business in the case of corn. And the other idea was, could you make a hybrid soybean, for instance? It would be very desirable if you could hybridize soybean, because then your customer would come back every year to buy seeds And it wasn't clear to us in the beginning whether you could protect a transgenic soybean. In principle, the farmer could take his seeds, his transgenic seeds, mm-hmm. and plant them again the next year, in principle. If you have a patent on that, then he shouldn't, whether he would or not, it's not clear. And whether you could be a big, mean seed company and sue him for doing that, that was going to be an ethical problem. So we talked about all these things, lots of ethical problems. I was astounded at the extent to which we had to get into that kind of thing. And that before really deciding what we were going to do, what we could make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 'cause with hybrid corn, it's you know, if you replant the seeds, you don't really get the hybrid vigor. So there's sort of a, right. a natural sort of, you know, thing there. But then...
Farmers are used to having to buy corn seed every year. Mm-hmm. But that's really... No. They feel like their rights are cramped on if you make them come back and buy more soybeans the next year.
I guess it's not, you know, really, I think, you know, around, you know, of course, there's the major court decision in 1980 that allows individuals to patent organisms, but for plants, it's even later on, I think, you know, around 85 or even 87, where, you know, that, it, you know, you can really begin to patent these plants and have that intellectual property protection. Was that a you know, I guess, you know, even before that, was that a concern, you know, for CBGIG that, you know, would, you know, would they be able to, you know, make their return on the investment for this research?
Yes. Yeah, they had plenty of concerns. Yeah. I can't remember. You seem to have a date there for when the permission for patenting a plant came out.
I think it's the ex parte Hibbard decision in the patent office, I believe, was 85.
Okay. And I think up until then, we did file a patent application on the technology for engineering the genetically engineered tobacco plant. While I was at the university, at Washington University, we did file a patent application on that. And it stood in limbo for a time until it was decided that you could even consider patenting that type of material. So that slowed that down for a time. We filed that, it must have been in 82 or 83. It had to be before the Miami River Symposium. We filed that. Or is it a year after that? Maybe it's a year after that. It was a year after the first time we talked about it, which was earlier. Yes.
Now with the BT corn, so you're working at, and that's basically incorporating the protection of the BT into the corn gene itself, mm-hmm. And in order to express the cry proteins.
Protein.
Yes. And you know, how was this? You know, are you having to learn a lot more, you know, biology in terms of working with the, you know, differences? Certainly, you're working with corn now, but also just working with the BT.
Yeah, bad things happen to the BT gene when you put it into the corn plant. And I have understood at one time, and I can't remember all the details, but I think one thing was that it the splicing mechanism of maize recognized part of the coding region, so it chopped it up wrong, or failed to splice it correctly, or something like that. It doesn't have introns because it's a bacterial gene, but I think the plant recognized something that it thought was introns, and so it chopped up the messenger RNA. Anyway, we had to fiddle with the actual sequence. We had to make a synthetic copy of the BT gene. The natural gene just didn't work at all.
So this would be a sort of a copy DNA, cDNA
No, not that kind of copy. It's you have to synthesize it using different codons from the Bacillus codons. You have to use plant codons. So, see, we have this wonderful thing called a genetic code. And, see, there are four ways to say leucine. There's six ways. Yeah. Okay. And maybe the Bacillus likes this one, and Corin only likes that one.
I see.
And for each codon in the corn plant, there will be a transfer RNA that has a complement to this, so it'll be able to read that codon out of the messenger RNA. But if corn has very little or no tRNA corresponding to that particular codon, then you're sunk. So you need to change the codons so that you're using ones that corn likes, that corn has plenty of.
I see. And so this is a lot of this work's being done in the you know mid 1980s, late 1980s. Were there other projects beyond? And what were you trying to transfer for the soy? Would that be herbicide resistance or tolerance?
I can't remember. Yeah, probably.
What were some of the other projects I get you know later on as I continued working on?
I don't know. I'm getting a little uncomfortable talking about the project portfolio that we had here. I don't know how much of that is
certainly no
public
need to
information. it may be already. I don't know. But. We must find something more interesting. More releasable than that. Let's see.
Yeah, were you, so at CBGIG, I guess, you know, here we've been discussing a lot of the science. You're a founding director and VP, so are you, you're taking on somewhat of an administrative organizational role now. How is that that transition to taking on that task?
It was okay. It wasn't wonderful. It was it looks like an important job with a lot of authority and so on and so on. But when you work in a big Swiss-headed headquartered company, the truth is that and just somebody in the chain of command. There wasn't really a lot that I could decide on my own. I had a direct line to my Swiss boss's telephone, so if anything came up, he wanted to know about it. I enjoyed the people that we were working with and the scientific problems that we were wrestling with. That part of it was fine, and I enjoyed recruiting people, and that aspect of it was fun. But, you know, I really don't have the heart of an administrator. I'm a scientist. That's what I really like. I like to do experiments. Mm-hmm. I like to see what happens and solve problems.
All right, talking about Vance Kramer, he said, I guess he was one of the first people that came before it. Are there others that are here from that time period?
Anique was pretty early on, I think.
Okay.
Anique DeFamo, you know her?
Right. Not well, but...
We have to go and look at that picture of all the employees with the old guys in the front.
So I have here in you know my notes could be off here, but that your tenure at CBGIG ended in 1993. Is that?
I can't remember if it says.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure it's right.
Well, where did you go after CBGIG?
I didn't go anywhere.
Okay, so it has more to do with the mergers and acquisitions.
We changed our name, yeah. But I also changed my job, so I don't know which one of those is happening in that time frame.
What job did you change to?
Well, I sort of became postdoc. they wanted John Riles to head the group. He was a young hotshot that we had as a manager in one of the teams. And I was allowed to do what I wanted to do, and so it was to go back to the bench. And I worked with my then postdoc, and she taught me all the new kits and all the new tricks that we had. So I've slowly grown into a molecular biologist again. There are plenty of people here who know more about other different things than I do, but I'm pretty good at one little part of the business. I work with the big plasmids, so I'm the go-to person if you have a big plasmid that's not doing what you want to do.
Now we're getting here into the mid-1990s, and I think it's around 1995, 1996, that the first transgenic crops become on the market, become available. What were your thoughts? Where you're really beginning to see, these applications actually become realities?
Yeah, that was certainly nice to see. It was not, the worry was that in Europe the technology was not really acceptable in many places. But yeah, nice to see that things are working. at least.
Yeah, in Europe, there is the from 1999 to 2003. There's the moratorium. There's a number of controversies that are emerging. There's Putztai, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, the potato study, that there were concerns about harming rats. There was the Losi study that thought to show that BT pollen was harming monarch butterflies. Chappelle and Quist that the transgenes from Mexican maize are transferring. And I know that most of those turned out to be they were incorrect, that they had problems. The journals oftentimes would say, we shouldn't have published that. What are your thoughts as some of this GMO controversy is beginning to build up this time?
I don't know how to answer that. I guess one thing I think my mentor here better muzzle me if I start saying bad things. But one thing I thought is, if transgenes did get into the land races of maize in Mexico, where's the harm? I mean, if the gene is making them a little better, they should be glad. And if it isn't making them a little better, it won't stick around, it'll go away. I guess the concern people might have is they want to eat food that's free from transgenes. But if they didn't look so hard, they wouldn't have noticed it. I don't know. And then let's see, what was the other case you brought up?
See, there, the Putztai rat experiment, the Losi butterfly.
The butterflies, yeah. I think one problem is that we always have to, you can't evaluate a technology in a vacuum. You have to compare this technology with what we would have otherwise. Okay, because it's not a... So if the farmer doesn't have a BT corn plant, he's going to spray insecticide. And I suspect that sprayed insecticide, no matter how you do it, has a greater likelihood of harming monarch butterflies than the occasional pollen spray that might escape into the neighborhood weeds. I mean, it's going to be a rare situation where it will be enough to harm a butterfly, I think, according to what I've read. I tend to read what I agree with, or like the rest of the world. But people act as though this is it's this or not this, and nothing else harmful will take its place. And I think we have to look at previous and future technology and compare those with transgenes. I think we're making an evaluation. I don't think we're gonna tie the farmer's hands. I think he's got to protect his crop. If he doesn't, there's going to be a lot of hungry people here.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to your transition to Syngenta. So we were discussing this earlier, the series of mergers of, you know, Ciba Geigy merges with Sandoz to form Novartis, and then they decided to spin off Syngenta to focus on the agricultural biotechnology, whereas the
agricultural business altogether, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so, how did was it sort of, you know, that just seemed to be the direction to go for you once those mergers took place?
What do you mean the direction to go? I mean,
well, that
we had our jobs, we kept working. They just changed the name.
Okay, so it was very much not really much of a. They're changing the names. You're continuing to do your science.
I guess some of the projects may have been affected, but transformation goes on. So you didn't notice it so much in this bunch.
Yeah, I think there were a bunch of name changes, different people at the helm in Switzerland. But I think for the teams that were here, they say largely unchanged. They say you get people come and go and some different strategies here and there, but. They said, well, they've changed the name out there three or four times since 1983. But I don't think, as far as the team here goes, I don't know that a lot has changed. And I think it was...
We got new leadership, I think.
Yeah.
Steve Evola left us at that point. And who became the head then? How's your history?
In 2000, I don't know. I've only been here 5 years.
It seems like we've had a number of heads since that time.
Right.
Up until then, I remember them because I knew them.
Yes, right. So, yeah, and I don't know, I just know going back, had Nikhil and Roger Kemble, and then the other guy who's now in Switzerland, I forget his name. Also recently, but then before that.
You did pretty well.
Well, I know, 2001, Syngenta and Myriad are mapping the genome of rice. Were you involved in this project? What were you focusing on at this time, sort of into the new millennium?
2000?
Mm-hmm.
go farther back. It says targeted integration. Oh yes. Yeah, we were using the INT gene of lambda bacteriophage to try to get site-directed integration into the tobacco plant, corn plant, sorghum plants. And we're still working on this kind of thing today, but not by integrase anymore. So if you ask me what I do, it is I work on targeted integration, and I work on gene stacking, delivery of multiple trans genes in one loop.
So the gene targeting is getting it so you more accurately sort of know where the transgene is going to end up in the gene.
Exactly. Yeah.
Behind wanting to do that. What are some of the problems with, not knowing where it's going to land in the genome and how it's going to be beneficial by being able to have a more targeted approach.
Okay. Well, there are several reasons. There's a list of reasons, but from the company's point of view, it should save money because when we put this gene in these different list of genes into the same place every time, it seems like the regulatory process could be streamlined. We don't have to explore all the genes around that place anymore. We know what they are. Just check it out. And we would then know that it doesn't do anything harmful to the plant itself if we've had experience with this target site. But the other side of it is, from our point of view, that if we put the transgene, in a good place in the maize genome, for instance, we can choose a place where it's expressed well and where the plant doesn't shut it off at just the wrong moment or any other moment. So we get experience with a good part of the chromatin of the plant. And we know we haven't hit anything valuable to the plant. We know we're not in the middle of a gene that's important to it. So it should work a lot better, especially if we can do it pretty efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
If it's extremely inefficient, it still might be better. But the less efficient it is, then the less incentive we have to do it that way. So we have to get a decently efficient method. Not easy.
How many genes are we getting into plants now? How hard is that compared to one? Or is it in the 20 years since you put the first one into a commercial product?
That's not the right question.
Okay.
The right question is, I don't know the answer to that, but the question I do know the answer to is, if you put in 23 genes compared to 2 or 3, how much you impair the efficiency, and it's not bad. I mean, I've forgotten 15% or something like that. Anyway. Could be better. But that may be the way life is. Long pieces of DNA get broken during processing, and there's certainly a lot of processing that Agrobacterium does to transfer it. But the history of the technology has taught us that things can really, really improve the more you refine them. and you look at the efficiency of transforming maize now compared to what we were struggling against years and years ago, yeah, it's unbelievable.
And you said that the other thing that you've been focusing on is the gene stacking.
Yeah.
Yeah, and tell me about, you know, the process there and, you know, again, the motivation between wanting to stack genes.
Well, the reason that you want to stack genes, you want to put your transgenes all in one package in one place, not put in a few and then put in a few 2 years later and so on. The reason is if you put them in four or five different packages, the breeder will have to treat those as four or five different genes. He's got to keep his eye on all of those. And it detracts from his ability to keep his eye on whatever else a breeder wants to keep his eye on. If we can have them all in one place, then it's just one, like one trait from the genetic point of view. So he won't have to waste a lot of energy watching it, keeping them together. I lost a piece of that question, though. You asked something else. Oh, well, how do we do it? Or
yeah,
why
yeah.
is it hard? Just working with big plasmids is technically a bigger challenge. As I said, some of us are good at it. I think that's my biggest one.
Oh, okay, the photo there. What are some of the traits, I mean, if you can talk about them, what are some of the traits that you're working on in terms of transferring to the crops?
Well, A, I don't know, and B, if I did know, I probably couldn't tell you. So, see you at the store. I do know, I lie to you, I do know some, not always, but yeah, some.
Have you worked on any other gene transfer methods, such as, you know, gene gun, you know, other than agrobacterium?
Yeah, I've shot the gun, yes. It really wrenched my soul something fierce. agrobacterium works better.
I've read that it's sometimes, if I'm not confusing this, but that it'll work better for dicots rather than monocots.
Agrobacterium?
Yeah.
Better for dicots than monocots? Who told you that? I don't think so.
I'll have to go back through my textbook here.
It might be out of date. Is it old?
It's pretty recent. I guess one of the, you know, one of the, from what I've read, one of the motivations for the gene gun was that that sometimes they would have difficulties using the agrobacterium as a...
Yeah, I've heard that one, yeah. That's pretty old, but yeah.
But that's something that's changed, where agrobacterium
would
be
changing.
Pretty...
Yeah. But everything depends on what you're trying to do, and the gene gun for sure has its place. And there are some projects that you have to do that way. So.
How do you how would you compare that to your experience? I know you're doing the agrobacterium, and then you do the gene gun. And what were you? Did you work with any kind of the older models or the more newer sort of helium gas gene guns?
I worked with whatever we had, which was state of the art at its time. So this is some years ago, maybe 8 or 10 years ago.
Okay.
I thought it was a helium gun.
Probably by that time.
I think so.
You know, talking to, you know, for example, in the papaya story where they're, you know, using, you know, just, you know, gunpowder, you know, shooting it, and, you know, the smell of, you know, burning onions or whatnot as a... Here we're you know, I don't want to keep you too long, and you know, you're being recognized, and here we can move to, you know, sort of some of the awards, the prestigious Benjamin Franklin Medal, you know, Academy of American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and so on. And then, of course, the most recently, the World Food Prize. Tell me, I know the World Food Prize was set up by Norman Borlaug.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me about, you know, just receiving that. Did you go out to accept it?
It hasn't happened yet. It'll be in October.
Okay. Oh, that's in Iowa?
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah.
October 17th.
Okay. Yeah, I was completely blanking on it. I may actually go out there and try to attend. There might be an event close by. But,
take your checkbook with you.
Yeah, it's $525 a person.
But
you should go. Yeah, there's a lot. The 14th and that brochure I gave you.
Great, and then that's the World Food Prize. They put that together.
Yes, right.
Well, great. I guess, you know, here if we maybe do just a couple last more reflective questions. One is, you know, for example, you write in your Agrobacterium a memoir, but perhaps the most important legacy from Agrobacterium has been its inspiration of confidence that foreign gene integration, even though DNA is sometimes delivered artificially, is a perfectly natural process. My most fervent wish is that well-meaning environmental proponents will come to recognize this and embrace the technology based on it. And this, you know, you're writing in 2000.
That was a good statement.
That was a good statement.
Yeah.
Sorry, do I still believe in that? Yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, how do you feel now? You know, we're talking, you know, over a decade later since you know, the controversy really began to take off.
I think it took off long before that. No, what's taken off is the technology, and now that there's more technology, there's more opposition, there's more to oppose. But I don't think the opposition has really become enhanced. The same people are making more noise.
Mm-hmm. Do you engage at all, like with you know, if they're, you know, a debate or something like that on the GMO transgenics issue?
I've done a little bit of that in the past. And one of the opponents of the technology attends my church.
Oh.
Coincidence. But that's all right, we're friends. It's just interesting. I didn't find out about him until he started writing letters to the editor of the local paper. He said, oh yeah, I remember you, I debated you one time.
What's his opposition? What's his objection?
That's the same answer.
Yeah.
He's one of those people that don't listen to anything you say and just falls out the other ear. Anyway, can I answer your question?
Yeah, I know, you know, that there's, you know, what will, you know, for example, the French researchers, Seralini and some of theirs, they'll, you know, come out, you know, most recently was the rat tumor study that was shown to, you know, critics and scientists showed that, you know, they were trying to argue that rats fed BT corn, the Monsanto BT corn, developed these, you know, enormous tumors in comparison to regular corn. And of course, critics showed that they didn't have the proper controls. They were using mice that were already tumor prone. All these other issues, and you know, it just happened. You know, in addition to Seralini sort of putting a gag order on journalists talking to any scientists if they received the paper. So basically, none of the scientific critics couldn't point out those issues beforehand.
These guys don't fight fair. Anyway, yeah, I'm not used by the company in debate. I don't know who is. You do that? Does Paul
do
that?
Would you
like to? Paul do that? I don't know.
We can use all the help we can get. But that'll be something, and I know we're looking at that as we look at your public presentations in October around the World Food Prize stuff. You talked about what do you want to say, and so we'll talk some more about that.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. I think it was the first time the World Food Prize has gone to transgenic research that
that's so. The thing is, I don't know the answer to this, but I question whether the audience really has, is the right audience for that message. I think it's not going to be filled with opponents of the technology. So we're preaching to the choir if we say that there, possibly.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's likely to be a little mixed, because you have people from all over the world, and certainly a lot of folks from production agriculture and people who are advocating for production agriculture, but I would say certainly not everybody, and there's probably some skeptics will be there, and certainly a lot of skeptics will be listening and watching for sure. Mm.
Anyway, interesting subject still under consideration here.
Yeah, well, I think, in this, kind of to wrap up our discussion here, maybe just sort of reflecting on how the biotechnology, and specifically agricultural biotechnology, has changed over the years. Like biotechnology itself, relatively new, but, there's there's mergers and acquisitions, there's changes in technology and so on. What strikes you as change, or if there, been big changes?
I'm not sure what you're driving at.
Well, I guess sort of looking back at the industry and your place in it, and how it's evolved, how it's changed, how it's remained the same, sort of over this long view, this long, relatively speaking, period.
What's changed and what stayed the same? I guess sort of, are there any
changes?
What's changed the most, and what's, I guess, are there things that are still constant?
About what, the process,
The industry, the science, the technology.
Well, the industry, I don't know. I can't speak to that. I don't know what you're after. And the technology, well, the technology has certainly gotten better and better. No question about that. I mean, we can do things now that we never dreamed of. Well, we dreamed of it, but didn't know how to do it some years back. So no, things have gotten much easier to do. They succeed much more often than they used to. But beyond that, I don't know how to address your question.
Totally fine. Are there any final thoughts, final things that you'd like to add at all?
I guess especially that last sentence in the paper that you just read, I would like to see the technology embraced
Well, Mary Dell Chilton and Steve Goldsmith, thank you very much for sitting down and taking the time to really share your story, share your career.
Sure. It's, glad to do it. And we get to review what you're going to write up.
Exactly.
Make sure that it's reflective of what we said.
Exactly.
What we think we said. What we meant.
Certainly. Okay. Great.
So what's your